I'm here to kind of introduce the topic to a certain extent in kind of a general sense, and then other speakers will add in their more specific experiences and facts, figures, graphs, things like this. But I want to stay a little bit philosophical about this, and so we will begin here. First of all, if you look at integrated pest management, as a formal program, it's over 30 years old now. And if you look at the beginnings of IPM, it was actually born at the same time as the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency at the time after Earth Day. So it was a kind of a environmentally sensitive time, and really the IPM program gained a lot of impetus through the environmental mood of the country at that point. However, when you work in extension as I do, you can't just say, well, there's environmental benefits, so you know you should adopt this on your farm. You have to show the grower that there's actually economic benefits to it. So all the way through the 70s and into the 80s, we developed IPM programs that were actually economically beneficial. And so it was, that's what really got us our adoption through those years. More recently, there have been regulations such as the Food Quality Protection Act, et cetera, and the demands of a changing marketplace for more healthy food and things like this, and that's really been the impetus for the kind of almost a renaissance period for IPM in the last, 10 years or so. And so what this shows is that it shows a couple things. One is IPM is a robust enough concept to accommodate all these changing social attitudes, and it also shows us as people who are invested in getting people to adopt IPM that we need to understand these attitudes and work them into our programs to make keep IPM current. So what are the tools that we use to stimulate adoption? Well, I'd like to divide these into two sides. One is what I call the supply side, which is a technology push, and also the demand side, which is a technology pull. Now, we've really worked on the supply side end of things in IPM. We would think of neat ideas in the university, and we would do research and turn those into extension programs, and then educate farmers about them, and hopefully they would get adopted. And actually, a lot of them were adopted, and it was quite successful. But with a changing kind of agricultural scene that we have now, just staying with the supply side approach needs to be augmented by other things, and so we need to look at the demand side of the adoption impetus here, or the technology pull side. And we have a couple of components there. One is government policy, and the other is the operations of the marketplace. And you've seen the impact of the rapid growth of organic production, hit or miss kind of opportunities with labeling for sustainability and even IPM labeling in some cases. You know that the population of the U.S. is becoming more green conscious and health conscious and that type of thing. And again, we need to be aware of these and kind of moving our programs in those directions. But let's kind of concentrate on the government end of things. And the government policy as it affects IPM can be divided into two sections. One is admonitory. If you do something, you might get a fine for it or put in jail or whatever. And we have several of those admonitory kinds of regulations. One are, of course, FIFRA, which is the main set of pesticide regulations that we all have to follow, and they greatly affect how IPM is done. More recently, we have the Food Quality Protection Act, which tells you essentially what you can't do that you might have been doing in the past, that type of thing. But another part of the government regulations, or maybe government opportunities, you might call it in this case, that we really haven't addressed that well in IPM are the promotional side of the government. These would be incentives, whereas the admonitory were disincentives, the promotional side are incentives. And there's a couple of them that are coming into prominence now. One we're going to concentrate on today, which is the Natural Resources Conservation Service incentives programs, and another one that's kind of just emerging is the Risk Management Agency incentives, which are all wrapped up in crop insurance and other things. So let's look at U.S. agriculture as a further impetus of why we should be going in this direction. One of the reasons is that You know, if you, all things being equal, you know, U.S. agriculture is fairly uncompetitive because it costs much more to produce food in the U.S. than it does, let's say, in, you know, in southern India or something like this. And so also we have in this country an artificially set food price almost. You know, we pay probably less than 9% of our disposable income on food in this country. You go to Europe, they're paying 25% to 30%. You go to South Asia, people are paying over 60% of the disposable income on food. And so, you know, cheap food in the U.S. is really kind of an unstated policy. Agriculture is a risky business with weather fluctuations and things like this. And also that even at the farm level, a great component of the income of a farm household actually comes from outside. It comes from outside of producing the crop. And so there's all of these risk management kinds of activities going on there. And one of the risk management activities that has gone on since the 1930s, actually during the Depression, is a transfer of wealth to the agricultural sector. Now, for many years, it was price supports. So if the price of your crop goes below a certain level, then the government will give you a payment. More recently, that turned into green payments. If you do things that are good for conservation, good for the environment, the government will give you a payment. So it's not like this is a cold turkey handout. The agriculture has always needed this, these kinds of wealth transfer schemes because of the economic situation that we're in. There are many, you know, if we look at just the NRCS green payment program, there are many programs within NRCS that provide green payment that has benefited IPM. And you'll hear more about these in detail a little bit later. EQIP Environmental Quality Incentive Program, the Agricultural Management Assistance Program, the Conservation Security Program, all have helped IPM along the way. And all of these programs have as goals to reduce the propensity for farmers to farm, you know, sensitive lands. It gives them a little bit of a an incentive to try some new technologies to improve the stability of farm infrastructure, reduce farm activities on the reduce the impact, the environmental impacts of farm activities, and to give you an idea of how much incentive that is. Just in Pennsylvania over the last 3 years or so, just for tree fruit production, you know, again, just in Pennsylvania, for the adoption of IPM, there's been a $1.3 million of NRCS funds that growers have been able to get to help them adopt IPM in just the 3 years. So there's quite a bit of potential here. And then also in Pennsylvania, we're expanding this program to sweet corn, grapes, and Christmas trees. Other kinds of incentives and disincentives that occur out there, the Risk Management Agency, which is a crop insurance program. If you look at the crop insurance, they are increasingly requiring that in order to qualify for the crop insurance, the grower has to do best management practices such as IPM. On the market side, food traceability. They want information on how that food was grown, processed, transported, etc., linked with the food. So you look at your plate, you'll be able to trace that, you know, broccoli or whatever, right back to the field. What happened to it? What pesticides were sprayed? These food traceability schemes that are actually being promoted by rather large companies require IPM best management practices to qualify for that kind of marketing. The whole eco-labeling movement, probably the highest pinnacle of that would be organic labeling and such. It allows consumers to make choices in the marketplace. And what are they making choices on? Well, a certain percentage of them are looking for best management practices like IPM. These consumers are increasingly preferring locally grown, and which is probably a bad thing to say in California, but locally grown, environmentally benign crop production practices. Of course, fresh, full flavor. They want them to be healthy. Food is becoming more of a social focus. You know, more time spent about food, watch the food channel, all that type of thing. And IPM can be a big part of this change in the psyche of the country. So if you look at all of the stuff I just talked about, all of those phenomena, whether they're NRCS or RMA or the marketplace, whatever, all include IPM. They all, and if you look at the details, they all require the same kind of IPM information, practices, the same kind of IPM message. And these programs are adoption incentives, just like in 1978, you would go out to a farmer and say, you try this IPM practice, you'll save $3 an acre. You can now say, well, not only we save $3 an acre, but you will qualify for these government programs. So several states have are active in this area, but there's a lot more states that could be, and even in those states that are active, there's a lot more activity that can happen. The CSREES, part of USDA, and NRCS are discussing how they can work together to promote this thing. The NGOs, such as the NRDC, is pressuring government to go in this direction. You'll hear more about these details later. But as Tip O'Neill says, former Speaker of the House, all politics is local. And if you're going to get something going in your state, you have to realize that the real action takes place, at this point anyway, at the state level. What they say at the national has some importance, but it's your relationship with the state NRCS that's important. All state IPM programs need to tackle this at the state level. You need, as an IPM coordinator or anybody else, need to join the state technical committee of the NRCS. That's where a lot of discussion happens. A lot of decisions kind of come out of those discussions. And there's a large cultural difference between the NRCS and the IPM community. We need to help teach NRCS people about IPM. They need to teach us about how NRCS works. We need to provide education for NRCS employees, and we need then to turn around and describe the benefits of joining an NRCS program to our farmer clients, so that you know, the training really has to go in both ways. So the following presentations, you'll hear a state IPM coordinator's view, a national political view. We'll have that panel of experts. You'll be able to input yourself with a survey. You'll have the NGO view, the non-governmental organization view, and then the another agency of USDA CSREES. You'll be able to hear what they have to say also. And I might say that in Pennsylvania, the person who really does the groundwork is Dave Bittinger, who's out in the audience here someplace. And any kind of detailed comments about how things happen in Pennsylvania, I'll redirect to him, and we'll have some time for a discussion at the end. So I think I'll end it there, Mike.
We'll have time for a question or two. Anyone have a question? Brett? The tough one is the kick-up talk. That's kick-up talk. Any questions? I think Ed will probably start stimulating questions as we go along.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
I was just so clear, number one.